Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago.
Well, good evening and welcome to Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser. I hope everyone's doing great this evening. We're having a wonderful time. My guest and I have been talking off the air, and I'm going to introduce you to my wonderful guest right after I do a little bit of housekeeping. And right now, it's absolutely necessary that I tell you that if you want to call in and ask any questions or say any statements, it's 516-453-6063. I will be posting this on my Facebook page and on Godly Entertainment. So if you miss this or want to hear it again, then you can then punch in and see the replay of that. I think I've gotten everything just about done. Go to Godly Entertainment and see us on Zoom, because we're going to do an after show afterthoughts with my wonderful, oh, I'm so happy to be able to say her name. She means so much to me. My wonderful friend, Miss Dana McBroom Mano. Hello, Dana.
Hello, hello, hello. How are you doing, my love?
I'm fine. How are you doing? How are you doing?
Well, you know, as I tell you, nothing ordinary ever happens in my family, so it's always some wild excitement, and we are living in times of biblical proportions. So things are happening, things that are unusual, things I did mention to you, I just had a friend who was on their way to my mom's yesterday who was attacked and is now in the hospital, but, you know, I said sometimes I'm just watching to see where the Most High is taking us next, because we are definitely on a journey. And then at the same time, I get home and I find out that Giuliani's home was raided this morning, so there are interesting things happening in the world.
Yes, it is. Well, you know, I have to talk about it, and I haven't done the proper introduction. Miss Dana Mano, as I call her, she is a choreographer, a director, an educator, a producer, a writer. Am I missing too much? Let me see. What else am I missing? Mother. She is a widow now, but was a wife. Extraordinaire. Everything that you can think of, I think Dana has experienced it. And we're going to, what I want to do is journey how I know her, which is probably the least eventful thing in her life. And then... go on to some of the wonderful things that I've discovered about you and your family. One of the things that I remember the first time I laid eyes on you, you were what, 8 months pregnant?
Yes, I was.
Yes.
Choreographing at 8 months pregnant.
And I mean, hook kicks and everything. It was an audition for a showcase called Shuffle Along. And I walked in the room and I looked at this lovely woman, and you were sitting at the time, so I couldn't kind of see it. And when she stood up, I said, oh, my goodness, she's pregnant. And then I was asked to sing and move and all these things. And I thought to myself, oh, please don't have this baby now. Don't have this baby now while you're showing me all these hitch kicks and everything. But it was an absolute divine experience. I remember the four of us, and I'm still looking for our friend DeBriah Chapman, but Roger Lawson and Verna Spencer completed the four of us in that showcase. And
yes.
That's the night. Remember, all of us met Ubi Blake, all of us together.
And he was such a wonderful, wonderful person, you know. He was just as sweet as he could be. And it was funny because I also want to mention his wife.
Oh, yes.
Because it was funny. She told me after one day when everyone was asking how he was, and she said, everyone's always asking how's Yubi, and nobody asks about how I am. So that's why I'm mentioning Mrs. Yubi Blake, because she did end up leaving us before he did.
Yes.
And, yes. So I said I will always remember that and mention it, because that was one of those cases. Behind every good man, there is a good woman, and she was a wonderful person as well.
As I mean, Marion was absolutely, Marion Blake was absolutely fabulous, and they were the sweetest people. Of course, they've been at my wedding and all of those things, and I would call them. But it was about the fact that Marion and Yubi would act like they were newlyweds. If a young, not a young girl, but a woman of in their age category. I remember we did a special with Alberta Hunter, and Alberta Hunter and Yubi had a little history.
Yes, we know.
Marion, and when Marion heard that Alberta, yes.
Yubi was quite a flirtatious man, and you know, I mean, it's funny because it's also a generational issue. I had a very good friend, film editor Harry Howard. I think he was the first African American to get into the Film Editors Union. I've been married twice, but my first husband and husband of 46 years, Franklin Mano, he was the second African American in the Film Editors Union. But that's a generational thing, because Harry used to tell me, you know, that in his day, if you didn't get 10 refusals from women a day, you weren't even trying.
No, I mean, and there was Yubi in his 90s, Marion probably just getting to be 89 or 88 or 90.
Yes, yes.
Alberta Hunter, who was, you know, in her 80s. And Marion would say, where's Yubi? Where is Alberta? And I mean,
yes.
I know. Well, we look at each other and go, we don't know, you know, because it was the three of us, Gregory, Maurice, and I doing this special with them. Anyway, I mean, she was full of life. It was unbelievable.
Well, you know, people talk about this often, but it is really, really true that inside of each and every old person is a young person wondering what the hell happened. Because we don't really, you know, when I think about it, I'm very blessed, you know. I say blessed and highly favored, because there are many friends of mine that I find out later that I'm much older than they are, and I've had no idea, because I don't feel any differently.
Exactly.
You know, you get a few extra aches and pains or something, and you know, maybe you have to stand up a little more slowly. But really, I must say here, and I really hope that every one of your listeners understands that saying, if you don't use it, you lose it, is real. If you keep kicking up your legs and doing everything that you have been doing, you will be able to do that until you leave here. But it's that we get tired and we stop and we don't do, and then it becomes harder to do. So I can only tell all of you, because I've been dancing and teaching class, and this is what's been so tragic about this year of COVID, because I haven't been able to do what I had been doing, teaching ballet, teaching Dunham Technique. And,
yes.
That's what
I really want to start talking about, how you studied with Miss Dunham and how all of that began. I know a little bit of the story because I heard it before, but tell a little bit of the story.
I think I've been very blessed. I've had two mentors in my life, Catherine Dunham and Gordon Parks Sr.
Mm-hmm.
These two people sort of guided me into being, you know, people say, oh, you do many things. And they said, and I remember him telling me, just tell them that you specialize in diversity. I do so many things, because they all had to do anything they could to survive. So you didn't have the privilege to say, I'm just a dancer. You didn't have the privilege to say, I'm just an actor. You had to do whatever you needed to do to survive. The only thing is that I promised myself that I would never do anything unless it was involved in the arts. In other words, I was not going to wait tables or do anything like that. Mm-hmm. I just said whatever I had to do, it would be involved in the arts. And it just so happened, my mom was a student at Juilliard.
Mm-hmm.
one of four people of color in her class at Juilliard when she went in. And she always tells me that she remembers that opening speech of the dean of the school when he talked to the incoming freshmen. And there were four black women in that class, but they were sitting at different places in the room. And the dean said, "You all have a fabulous future in your lily white hands." And she said that their eyes flashed to each other across the room. But my mother being at Juilliard got her into doing something unique, and I don't think no one has to do it now. But all of the sheet music that people used to see back in the day was not done on a machine. All sheet music was done by hand. People were sitting in a room writing out sheet music to every song, every show that we saw. And a man by the name of Herb Hoffrecht brought my mother into that industry because she had a very excellent, she loved calligraphy, so she had a wonderful handwriting. And she used that to help support our family, writing music for people. And she even began to write out sheet music for her professors at Juilliard. And she did that for very many years. As a matter of fact, my mother worked for Mayor Beam here in New York for a while, and she often had to sign certificates and sign his name because she could imitate any handwriting, and she had a perfect penmanship. It was, it, you know, and sometimes there are jobs that people don't even know that this is a way you can make a living. And you'd be surprised how many different ways people make livings. But that's what one of my sisters said to me one time. She said, "When I'm out of work, I have to wait for someone to hire me. When you're out of work, you create a new job."
Exactly. You know, there's so many things that you can do, you know, and it's amazing.
So I went with my mother to Catherine Dunham's office because my mother was always an entrepreneur and she loved international life and international travel. So she was booking the tour for the Dunham Company, and I went with her to see Miss Dunham, and she went in to meet Miss Dunham, and I was just sitting out in the ante room waiting for my mother to come out of a meeting. And Miss Dunham's assistant, Lucille Ellis, came out and threw some leotards at me and said, "There's a class starting. Get in there." And I said, "I'm not here for class. I'm just here with my mother." And she said, "Well, your mother's going to be a while. Put on these leotards." And, I mean, she was on me. And that started a journey in my life that was quite unique and amazing.
But
because
now, Dana,
it was not...
had you been dancing before then? Had you been, how long had you been dancing?
Yes, no, I had always been dancing. As a matter of fact, I was expelled from ballet class at the age of four because even then I loved comedy. And there were these two African-American women teaching ballet, the Facey twins, they used to call them. But I loved to make jokes in the class. And they said that they had trouble teaching because even though they kept hold of the students, that they kept laughing. And so I got expelled from my ballet class at the age of four. So then I studied with a wonderful woman by the name of Anne Green, and she was brilliant. She was in a group called the Dawson Art Society that promoted African Americans and opera. And so, so it was very interesting. And she had both my sister Marcia and myself in her dance classes. And it's so amazing how the world is, because I used to travel on the subway at the age of five to her class by myself.
Woo!
And you could do that then. You can't do that now. You'll never see your child again. But at that time, it was a short, a few stops on the subway to the class. And it was funny because Miss Green told me one day, she said she saw me on the way to class. And she was wondering, she said, "But I walked with such confidence, no one would dare come over and bother me." And so she had us doing in all sorts of operas back then, doing the dance, being the dancers for various operas. And how hilarious that one of the operas that she did all the time was Aida. And when I started dancing with Miss Dunham, I took class, and she got me an audition at the Metropolitan Opera. She was going to be the first African-American choreographer at the opera under Mr. Rudolph Bing. He was the manager for the opera. And let me tell you, you know, racism, of course, is alive and well.
Yes.
Because he is the first manager for the Metropolitan Opera that they did not let him come back into that building after he retired. And that was because of all the African-American singers he brought into the opera. He brought in Leontine. He brought in Martina Arroyo. He brought in so many people of color, including Catherine Dunham, to choreograph Aida. And they never forgave him for that. They never forgave him. They started to say, oh, he's a little crazy. He was not crazy. He just liked black people. And I will never forget the first day. And Lyndon Baines Johnson was in the audience, and it was that first day. And he came out because I was in the opera. I auditioned in front of Dame Alicia Makarova, along with other dancers from the Dunham Company. But I was chosen because they were only choosing a certain number of people. And he came out before the curtains opened in the Omnera scene with Leontine to make sure I was okay, that I was comfortable. He was so wonderful and so attentive. And he said it was just time for people to come in. And it was so funny because the summer before that season opened, Miss Dunham said, well, if I have to use these other ballet company members, they've all got to come and study at the Dunham School for the whole summer before the season opened in the fall. And all of these ballet dancers walked into the Dunham School, which was on 42nd Street at the time, and they had their noses so high in the air. And they were just, you know, their disdain was palpable. And
yes.
They walked in there, and the class started. And they couldn't even make it through the class. And their attitudes totally changed because Dunham Technique kicked their behinds. And when the season opened in the fall, of course, Miss Dunham had a degree in anthropology. So she worked with the costumers to make sure that everything was authentic in terms of the time period, in terms of what the Egyptians were wearing, in terms of what the Ethiopians were wearing. She brought in Kim Foy Padu, who was a martial artist at the time, and he gave us all karate lessons because she wanted that triumphant scene in the square to be authentic. Because if you've ever been to Africa, especially North Africa, you always have all sorts of artists and performers in the bazaar and in the square. So she wanted it to look really authentic,
What year was that, Dana? What year? Do you remember what year that was?
Gosh. No, I don't. And I, you know, it's funny because I have a girlfriend now who has a commercial running on television, and she says, I love their tagline. She says, age is only a number, and mine is unlisted. So,
yes, I see that.
So
yeah.
I mean, if I need to, I can always go online and check on the year that was. But it was...
But it was such a
wonderful experience because of the people who were in it, and we had so many crazy things happen because, of course, I knew the entire opera from having worked with Anne Green and the Dawson Art Society. So my sister and I both knew, and my mother said she was so proud to stand in the back in the Metropolitan Opera, seeing us up on stage after doing Aida. And I was in that company for more than 5 years,
dancing as
a member of the ballet company.
Now that you've mentioned your mother, I really need you to talk about Mrs. Marie McBroom for a minute. Tell me, I know that, you know, one of the things that I found out, and I cheated, of course, that she was a Juilliard graduate.
Yes.
She was the first accompanist for Harry Belafonte.
Yes, she was. And she and Belafonte were great friends and still are. I mean, she hasn't spoken to him over this COVID year, but yeah, they're still friends.
And then was secretary to W.E.B. Du Bois?
Yes, my mother was the secretary for W.E.B. Du Bois, and the funny thing is that she And she started the youth corps for the NAACP in Harlem. She was the head of that. And that's how she met my father, because my father was, they were both very involved in politics, both political activists. My father had been in the Army, and he is in the Eleanor Roosevelt Museum because he was one of her liaisons to integrate the armed services. Mm-hmm. And he was best friends with Paul Robeson. And so we had this all around us. Malcolm X was a constant visitor in our home. As a matter of fact, it's funny because you never know at the time what when you're in the midst of history, you don't realize. And yes. Malcolm used to come to our home all the time just to discuss politics with my mother. And it was very funny because even when he was on the road, he used to write her letters and things like that, which, of course, she would read and didn't keep. But my mother collected postcards, and he sent her lots of postcards on his travels. So I still have many postcards to my mother from Malcolm X.
Oh, are you friendly with the family, with the daughters at all?
We were my mother was very friendly with them for quite some time. I haven't been in touch with them now in a good 10 years or so. But we were close with them. They used to come to events with us all often, and it was a very interesting family. And I also learned some very interesting things because Malcolm, we had a house in the Bronx, and as a matter of fact, Morris Avenue between Tremont and Burnside, and that block has been designated a national landmark because it had these great brownstones.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very funny. I really wanted to buy back the house that we had, and when I went to check, someone had just purchased it. I just checked on it like 2 years ago, and someone had just purchased it because the inside of that particular brownstone was unique. You may know he's the head of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Nile Rodgers.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yes, no.
Niles' stepdad, Graham Benskin, was a contractor and architect, and he came inside because our house was a central point. It was so funny because my mother was such an international person. When all of those African countries were getting their independence during the 60s, our house was meeting central. And sometimes the police would have to come and close off our block because of all the limos coming in there. So because we'd have parties and meeting places and, you know, people playing in the living room like Ahmed Jamal and Abdul Malik and then Belafonte and Poitier, and all these people would come there because my grandmother always had food on the stove.
And well, food will get you. Yes, food
yes.
And art. Yes, they will, yes, they gravitate to food, absolutely.
And yes, and so there were parties on the weekend, but these are the people that I saw, that I was around as a young person growing up, all these luminaries who were just friends of ours, you know, who were just friends to the family. And I also learned a lot about being, I guess I'm a dyed-in-the-wool feminist in a way, because my grandmother was from the island of Montserrat in the Caribbean. And I would say Montserrat is a little bit of a matriarchal place. I saw my grandmother. Her husband died when she was pregnant with her last child. She came over here from Ellis Island from the Caribbean. And I have her certificate on my wall here from when she came over. But she did very well. She came here as a master seamstress. So even though she was here during the Depression, she did very well, because just like now, when the whole country is poor, the rich people are still rich. As a matter of fact, I think they've gotten wealthier during this pandemic than any other time in history. So even though people were going through poverty, these wealthy women still wanted their ball gowns. And my grandmother would make them.
That's fabulous.
So,
now, I have to, you know, now we're almost 30 minutes in, and I haven't talked about your father, and I haven't talked about you and Adelphi. So I have to, you know, I've got all these things.
Please. My life is, yes.
All right,
so my dad.
Yes, about your dad. All right, and Columbia, right?
Yes. Yes. Well, my dad got his doctorate at Columbia University, but he also went to Wilberforce University. He went to Tuskegee, but thank God they didn't get to experiment on him because my dad did not smoke and he did not drink, but he loved women and women loved him. And several of the white women around there loved my dad, so they shipped him out of there real fast. But so my dad got went, and when he saw my mother, he had never even heard of Montserrat. So he and neither had, I mean, very few people have heard of Montserrat. So he was like, I met this black woman from Montserrat. And he thought my mother was absolutely fascinating. And, of course, she was a classical pianist. That was her specialty, classical piano. But because she was Caribbean, she knew how to play all these calypsos and you know, she was very good friends with Irving Berge, who wrote most of those songs that Belafonte sang. So my mother played with these people, and my dad went to school on a GI scholarship and got his doctorate at Columbia. And I will never forget because, you know, Columbia is they have problems there in terms of I would say people who are diverse, because when I got my master's degree, I remember my professor that I got my master's with, he's told me that they, just when he was getting ready to graduate with his doctorate, they claimed they lost all of his papers. So it seems like that's one of those things that they do, and he had to end up going to NYU and finishing his degree. Same thing with my father. A week, I think it was a week before graduation, they claimed they couldn't find three of his math credits, so he wouldn't be able to graduate with his class. Well, they didn't know about Marie McBroom. My mother went up to their office, and they said, well, we're so sorry, we just can't find them, and things is too busy for us to look through everything right now. And my mother says she doesn't know what got into her, but she leapt over the counter and told them she'll help them look through the papers, and suddenly they found everything, so he was able to graduate. And, yes.
Amazing. All these tales that we have, it's just amazing stories that we have to that we are told, you know, in our history, and we're going to talk about oral history in a minute, and you know, it's passed on for us, and the struggles that our parents and grandparents. But now I just want you to describe where your grandmother came from. You know the island, you know what it is. I've heard, and we've talked about it, but if someone's never been there, tell me the most beautiful thing about Montserrat.
Well, Montserrat is called the Emerald Isle of the Caribbean because it's volcanic and it is extremely lush. I mean, I've even had people from other Caribbean islands look at pictures of Montserrat and say, did you fix the color? Did you add some extra? Montserrat is very, very, very lush. As a matter of fact, soon after, we had a volcanic eruption about 20 years ago, so we understand what the people of St. Vincent are going through now. But when I went back home, I found like 4-pound mangoes and things like that. I mean, and anything can grow there. And it was also the place where the Beatles did a lot of their recording. They had a Sir George Martin, the Beatles producer, built a studio in Montserrat called Air Studios. And so it was great because it's very secluded. You can't just fly into Montserrat. You have to go into Antigua and then take a small 8-seater or a puddle jumper, as we would call it, over to Montserrat. And so as a result, even right now, they don't have any COVID there, which is why I'm trying to get back there as soon as I can. But what was nice is that when I was there, I'd sing in the nightclub sometimes at night. And it was great because you'd go and because they only had two clubs on the whole island, and they were across the street from one another. One was a yacht club, and one was the other one called the Green Flash. And so you'd be singing, and Mick Jagger would be in the audience, or Stevie Wonder, or the members of Duran Duran, and because there was nothing else to do on the island, and that is what is also so incredible. They say it's on one of these spiritual ley lines of the planet, and it's something that happens to you when you go there. If you're a creative person, you start getting more creative. Like if you're a songwriter, songs will, it's like they come up out of the earth. Writers, I sent a friend of mine, Edgar Nkosi White, he's been dubbed by the Queen of England and everything, but anyway, he told me he was, and he, and anyone who's in black theater will know Edgar White and his writings. But
exactly.
Edgar told me what he had some was having writer's block. So I said, well, you know, you're a month's ration. Why don't you go home for a couple of weeks and chill? And that was 6 years ago. Edgar went, and he said he's never coming back. And he has been so prolific since he's been there. The writing is incredible. And whenever I go, songs just come out. I just wrote a song called Cookie Jar when I was there the last time because, man,
well,
it
wait,
says.
Let's talk about the song. Before we go too far, you have written a song that who, no one but the diva herself, Grace Jones, sings. So tell me about that. Tell me about the song.
Okay, so Grace Jones. You know, Grace, it's funny, I just spoke to her brother, Chris Jones, who is my heart. And I mention this really deliberately because there would be no Grace Jones without Chris Jones, because he was a DJ on the radio in Paris when she was just starting out, and her singing wasn't that great at the beginning, but he was a DJ, so he played her songs on the radio all the time, and she grew into herself, and then she met Jean-Paul Goud, who photographed her spectacularly, and whom she had a son for. Paulo, but she was also at the same modeling agency with my sister Marcia, Black Beauty Modeling Agency.
Yes.
And I went over to her house, you know, and I was teaching at Adelphi University. And when you're a professor, you have January off for winter break. And I'm over at her house, and we're just hanging out. And she said, I don't know what I'm going to do. She said, I have to go to Compass Point in the Bahamas to record, and my babysitter just quit on me, and I don't know what I'm going to do. And I had just had my daughter, Chainana, at the time, and who's around the same age as her son. And I said, well, look, I'm off for the entire month of January. I said, I'll go with you, and I'll take care of the babies while you record your music. So it happened just that wonderfully. So I went with her to the Bahamas. We lived together for that month. But one day, the producer of the song was Chris Blackwell. And he had a beautiful sauna right on the beach. And Grace and I were in the sauna chilling out. And I said, you know, Grace, I wrote a song. And she said, you wrote a song? I said, yeah, I wrote a song. And she said, well, why don't you sing it to me? And I sang Pull Up to the Bumper to her, and she flipped. She said, that song is fabulous. I want to put that song on my album right away. And like as they say, the rest is history. And it's been it was redone by Patra a few years later. I often say, that's why I say I'm blessed and highly favored, because it seemed like any time that I was having money problems, someone else would re-record Pull Up to the Bumper or put it on something and I'd get a check. There's nothing better than passive income, I tell you, my friend.
Oh, I understand. I understand quite well. I've been blessed in that way, too. And I am blessed and highly favored. I say that and write that very much. I still have to talk about a little bit about your family anyway, because it's an extraordinary experience that you have sisters and brothers. And it's an array of things, and how the arts has brought not only politics, it's brought so many different things into your life. So, you know, you are what they called a blended family, all of you in this generation right now. Your mother is still alive.
Yes, she is.
Yes. And
my dad married three times. So
yes.
My mother was the first wife. And I laughed because I think when you heard me speaking with my sisters, when my father passed away, all three wives were at the funeral services, and I said, he finally has the African ceremony he's always wanted, because they were all there. And my mother said she was very happy that he had married these other women, because she said she loved all of the children. And she said she wouldn't have had the other children had he stayed with her. So, and I love my siblings. You know, my father never allowed us to think of ourselves as step brothers and sisters. We've always been close as just brothers and sisters, period. And everyone is unique. Everyone has a different gift. And they've all been wonderful. And his second wife, Pearl McBroom, she was fantastic. She was the first woman to have her own cardiology practice, and certainly the first African-American woman, and she was even recognized by the American Medical Association for her advances in cardiology. So, so we've always been a blended family, but I think we all get so much of our drama from my father. My father was he was always so expressive, and I tell you one thing he left in his will, that I should tell someone a joke every day in his name. And I thought it was crazy, but it's been so wonderful, because while he was alive, whenever we heard a joke, we would call each other from wherever we were in the world and just laugh our heads off. And even now I hear a funny joke, and so I've been trying to keep that up, and it's been wonderful, because since people know it, I get calls. People call me up when they hear jokes. I got in a cab one day, and the cab driver says, "I remember you, lady. You told me a joke." And he gave me a free ride. I've gotten free drinks in restaurants. There's a West Bank Cafe right here on 42nd Street.
And
Steve in there, he's waiting for me to give him a joke when I go in, and he's given me free wine for my jokes because he said I made him laugh so much. So my father was just a very unique individual who was brilliant. He had a photographic memory, so you couldn't argue with him too much, because he'd not only remember what book he read it in, but the page and the date. very, very brilliant man. And as I said, he's the only man, like I said, I've seen him get into a car accident looking at a woman, because he loved beautiful women. And I think that's why God blessed him with so many daughters. That's why he kept getting married. He didn't get any sons until the third wife. And my two brothers are wonderful, wonderful young men. And as a matter of fact, my youngest brother is a year younger than my daughter.
Oh, my goodness.
So she has an uncle that's younger than she is.
I want to talk about your career as an actress, as well as a choreographer. Talk to me about Lead Belly.
Oh, wow. You know, you said that and it just gave me chills, because it's funny, because, you know, Madge Sinclair jumped into my mind. Loved Madge Sinclair. And anyone who has not seen Lead Belly, it's on Ovation TV. I saw it on there the other night. I saw it in the listings. And it's been coming on the air quite a bit lately. But Roger E. Mosley playing Lead Belly, did such a fantastic job. And just the cast in general, Loretta Green. Loretta Green.
Yes. Loretta Green.
What a person.
We haven't heard for a while, and I want to go, you know, we should have a round table with all of them, you know.
And yes, that would be a wonderful thing. And Art Evans playing opposite Roger as Blind Lemon Jefferson. Now let me tell you about Art Evans, and he's another fantastic, fantastic human being. So when I went to audition for Lead Belly, it was interesting because my sister Marcia knew Gordon, and he wanted her for this part of Margaret Judd. And Marcia got the script and read the script and said, "No, this is my sister Dana." And I went to that audition and read the lines. It was in Dino De Laurentiis' office here in New York. And I read the lines, and then Gordon told me to wait outside. And then all of a sudden, after a few other people had gone in, he comes out to me and he says, "All of these actors are telling me what a great choreographer you are. Could you choreograph something for me?" And I'm like, "Now?" He says, "Yes." And Art was there auditioning too, and he had his guitar. And he said, "Art, go in the room there with her and play something for her." And wow, that was a wild day because it was hot in New York. I think it was in August because it was like one of the hottest times of the year here in New York. And that was in those crazy days where we were walking around in see-through clothing and everything. But I had on, yes, darling.
You were
so I had on one of these T-shirt dresses down to my ankles, but I didn't have on anything underneath that dress. Because it was hot. But I went into the room and Art played that guitar and I choreographed something because Art was so much fun. And mm-hmm. I came out and Art played and I danced for Gordon. And he said, I need a choreographer for this movie. And he hired me as a choreographer for the film. In fact, he used to laugh after the film was done because he said, your name appears in the credits more than mine. And as a matter of fact, they were
about your character. Tell people about your character in Magnolia. Right.
Oh, well, in the film, it was so great. And of course, Ernie Hudson. How can I not mention Ernie Hudson?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
He played Leadbelly's nemesis in his hometown. But in mm-hmm. any case, my character was that I was his first girlfriend, and then he gets me pregnant and has to leave town.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fun because I got to work with musicians that had actually worked with Leadbelly, because this Fred, what's his last name? I'm the musical director. He did research and found some musicians that had worked with Leadbelly, and so I got to be in all the pre-production with the music. I got to then cast all of the dancers. And it was so funny because I have one girlfriend of mine, Mary Vivian. She used to be one of the Flipettes on the Flip Wilson show. And she also went to the Dunham School and had lived with my family because that was the other thing. When people came in, since we had a brownstone, Miss Dunham, any young dancers, she would send them to stay at our house. And my grandmother, again, fed everyone and took care of everyone. But I called the Screen Actors Guild because I said, I know she's in the union. So I made them find her because that's one thing I do. I reach back because when you work with people, it is very important that everyone get along. As a matter of fact, when I was casting for UB, everyone was laughing because I was asking everyone their astrological signs, Oba Baba Tunde and Elaine, or everyone that came in, I would ask them what their astrological, and I heard them outside talking, that lady is crazy. She's in there asking everybody their sign and everything. But I wanted everyone to be compatible, and I think everyone stayed friends for life because of that.
We all have. You know, we've lost a couple of people, which you know.
Of course.
No,
well, let me tell you something, because the first person of my two Hines brothers, Maurice and Gregory, Maurice came and auditioned for me first.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, how can you not love Maurice Hines?
Yes.
And Maurice asked, he said, would you mind auditioning my brother Gregory? Now, Gregory had gone off being a gypsy in Europe and hanging out, so he hadn't been performing in the United States in a while at that time. And, of course, I know, I teach theater history, so I knew about Hines and Dad. And when he said Gregory Hines, I'm like, yes, bring your brother in here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Julie Boyd and Ashton Springer and them, for some reason, they said Gregory, they literally said, he's not good looking enough. He's not what we want. And I said, you guys don't know what a good-looking black man is then, if that's what you're saying, because I thought Gregory was one of the sexiest, most handsome men of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate at that time that I said, if we don't hire Gregory, we're not moving forward.
Yep.
And I think that was why when we went through tribulations with that show, that Maurice and Gregory were fighting so hard for me because they knew I fought for them.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just one of those things where it's interesting, and over the years, I have found that there are so many stories of people who are in productions, but their journey to get into the production was really something not smooth at all, you know.
And I never forget, like they say, who brought me to the dance. You know, I go back and get people because listen, there's a stage manager, and I'll call her name, Jackie Casto. I worked with her in a show with Roxy Roker called The Bomb Yard some years ago, and it was funny because the show was so fabulous and so incredible. And I told her, I said, Jackie, I said, you are the best stage manager I have ever worked with. I said, if I ever get something where I can pay you for your skills, I will call you. And it took me 20 years, but I had something where I had a big budget, and I called Jackie. She said she almost fell out of her chair because she had retired. And I said, no, girl. I said, I told you. She said, you're really a person of your word. I said, yes, I am. And she has continued. She came out of retirement and has continued to work with me for years. She was working with me. I've been teaching for the past many years at Fashion Institute of Technology. I'm a professor there. I'm still on their faculty. And we started doing a dance. I became the director for their theater ensemble. I brought in Jackie Casto, and the school had a lighting person, but I found my Antoinette Tynes, and I brought her in to do my lighting. And we had fabulous shows until the European-Americans there were very upset. They started getting intimidated, and this man came up to me one day, and he said, because the students were allowed to pick who they wanted to direct their shows, and he told the students, if you pick that Dan Amano one more time, I'm dissolving this entire theater ensemble.
Oh, how sad that is. That's sad.
I know. Well, guess what? I didn't want it to anything to end because of me. So I said, "Oh no, I'll you can give the position to someone else." They have not done a major production since I left that position. But we did fabulous things. We did Into the Woods. We did Guys and Dolls. We did Cabaret, and I did it with all the bells and whistles because I knew all my friends from Broadway. I brought in Ray Nakari as my musical director. We had Broadway musicians for every show, and many of my students from the theater ensemble, you know, I had them intern, you know, as stage managing under Jackie, and so they all knew how to call a show, and yeah. Costume designers. I brought in costume designers from Broadway and had them work with the costumers, and so we did fantastic productions. As a matter of fact, I remember...
That's the advantage of being in New York. That's why I studied in New York at Hunter under Lloyd. You work with people on Broadway, so when you are finished with school, you're ready to go and become a professional.
That is the unique situation.
That is where you want to study. You want to study in any institution that has that in their environment. That's what you want.
But let me tell you, though, Lenny, people, you know, people have to have, no matter what it is, you have to have vision, because Fashion Institute of Technology is right in the heart of Manhattan on 27th Street, right off of 8, between 7th and 8th Avenues, and they're part of the State University of New York system. But they have their theater arts majors up in Purchase, New York, way upstate somewhere, where they should have it down here in Manhattan so that all the students can take advantage of Broadway.
Yes.
But they don't get it. I mean, but, you know, when they hired me at FIT, they brought me in to teach one dance class in the health and phys ed department. So I came in teaching Afro-Caribbean dance and teaching Dunham techniques. I got them so many dance students that they had to change it to health, phys ed, and dance, and then had to change it again now to film, media, and performing arts because of all the students that came in. You know, they just don't have any vision. You know, they don't understand what they have there. They don't. Here they are, a fashion school, and they didn't even have a class in costume design.
Oh, you're kidding. Really?
Yes, really. I mean, they had other fashion things, but they didn't have costume design.
Costume design. You know, it's very, well, now I'm going to say this. We're down to 10 minutes, okay?
Oh,
I
no.
Knew, yes. I knew this was going to happen. I knew that this was going to happen, that we were going to do this. But I want to talk a little bit about, you know, I want to talk a little bit more about the varied levels of your career. You've done the education. You've done the performances that most people don't really regard you as a performer. You're a wonderful performer. you know, Dana.
And it's very funny because I tell you my sweet Franklin Mano passed away in 2016. And I married again to a wonderful man who was in advertising, but an artist. I like my artsy-fartsy guys. Because Franklin, as I said, Franklin was a film and video editor. He worked for CBS News for many years, too, editing news footage. And his memorial service, people said they would have paid to be at the memorial because of all the artists and friends of mine who came and sang and performed. Catherine Russell came and sang. Kathy, wow. I met my husband he was a backup singer in a band that I had. My mother introduced me to him. And he had just come out of the Air Force, coming from Vietnam. And, he was, I would say, even better than like a Frank Sinatra. Franklin had the most wonderful, wonderful voice. But, it was just an incredible, my poor second husband, I had just been cast in a gospel musical, and I'm a singer, but, you know, gospel people sang. But I did a show, and it'll probably come back on the boards, called Whose Side Are You On by Deirdre Kelsey. She has a cable show called Sister Talk that comes on.
Mm-hmm.
But she wrote a wonderful stage play called Whose Side Are You On, and it's about gang life, because she said she saw a gang shooting out right outside of her home in Washington, D.C. So she did a play about, are you on God's side or are you on the side of criminals? And I had a wonderful role in that. I played the preacher's wife, which was just about perfect for me because I'm also the chaplain for the Muntzrat Society here in New York, and I'm very much about spirituality because I keep telling people, Lenny, we are just spiritual beings having a human experience, and we're all going to the same destination. So it's very important lessons you learn along this journey. And once you really understand this concept that we are really just spirits going on, because I've had things where whenever you have a deja vu experience, it's because you really have seen it before. See what's going to happen to us before we get here. And I often wonder why people take particular journeys, but I know because I've been in situations. The first time I went to Paris with my mother was engaged to the foreign minister of the Cameroons, and she told him, I cannot marry you without seeing your country, and I can't come to your country without bringing all my children. So she took Marcia, myself, and my sister right after myself, Edith. And Edith was from my mother's second marriage to the ambassador from Liberia, C.T.O. King, and so his father had been president of Liberia. But in any case, she takes us all to the Cameroons. We stayed there for many, many months. It was the most beautiful experience. But we came through Paris, and my mother went to the apartment of a friend. And Lenny, I'm telling you, it was very weird. I had never been to Europe before. I had never been to Paris before. But the neighborhood where this woman lived, I knew everything in the neighborhood. I knew every store. I knew the entire neighborhood, and so did my sister-in-law. I knew I had been there in some other time, in some other space, in some other life. So, I've seen it happen before. My girlfriend, Mary Vivian, she often talks about the time when she was a child. She said, and she felt her head, and she said, wait, my hair wasn't like this before. Sometimes, so I tell everyone, be right with yourself. Be right with who you are, because even if something struck me down at this minute, I know that I am right with the Most High. And I know that it's all about love. It's so much about love.
You know, I think that there are people who have that vision, but it's stronger in some than others. I think people get deja vu, but you get it slightly. And you kind of go, that feels familiar. But then there's some people who actually relive it. It depends upon your strength and spirituality. And, you know, this world is surrounded by all the spirits. You know, a lot of people talk about white lights and all those things. And I think if you, for me, if you are good to other people, then other people should be good to you and will be good to you. And if they're not, you need to really say a prayer for them. But as I told my mother many times now, I'm not that religious, so I'm not going to be that nice to them when they're not good to me. So.
Well, Lenny, like I told you, when I see wild situations going on, that's why I said everything for me is about the arts, because I look at a situation and I say, now, what a movie is that? Now, do I want to watch this movie or do I want to be in the movie?
Exactly. Do I want to be it? Do I want to watch it happening or do I want to be in it? Well, now,
yes.
All right, I have to slow you down because we're under 5 minutes. And
yes, okay.
I'm going to have to do some of my housekeeping to make sure that next
yes,
week
tell me.
Everything. But now, Dana, I'm not finished. So I'm going to have you come back because, but it'll be a little while. I know you have a busy life. You travel and everything else. And now that we're all beginning to travel a little bit more, I'll have you back a little bit later in the season. And we have to talk more about you. Your family fascinates me. The blendedness of them, the history of your mother and father, but also and your connection with Catherine Dunham and how you have really sustained that in and her dance technique all these years. You have really kept her alive. And I think that that's absolutely fabulous, you know.
Well, the funny thing is that she had me listed as one of her main master teachers. And for some reason, her daughter got very upset with me and called their foundation and said, take her off the list. You know, but I said, you can't negate my life, you know, because whatever you do, this is, you know, this was the life that I lived. And her mother asked me to promise to keep her technique, not just in the classroom, but on the stage. So whenever I choreographed something, I always used Dunham technique. I was working at Ballet Hispanico. My students there, as a matter of fact, you can probably find it on Facebook. They did a beautiful dance called Carnival, and it's on YouTube, and it's beautiful, but all Dunham technique.
That's true.
And, you know, and every time I do a show, I always use, when I was doing Yubi for you guys, I used Dunham technique. I always use Dunham technique because it's such a diverse technique. Such a diverse technique because she did jazz. She did Afro-Caribbean. She did everything. And she said that you have to know how to do everything to survive. And she taught me that because she was an actor. She was an anthropologist. She did all those things. And I've tried to trace her steps. I've gone to the Pacific. Oh, gosh, that's the other thing we have to talk about. My time in New Zealand and Australia and Bali and Singapore and Thailand and China. And
yeah, well, now I'm going to stop you right now because I'm going to segue that into saying that, you know, it's wonderful having you and your history. Next week, I'm going to have Celeste Bedford Walker, and that's another history. She has written a play, Greenwood, An American Dream Destroyed, among 40 other plays, but this year is the 100th anniversary of that disaster, so you can relate to historic things going on. So I'm going to have another historic conversation next week. You ladies are going to wear me out. I'm telling
you.
Well,
and you know, of course, I've called on you to do Millennium 7 about senior citizens, isn't that apropos right now?
Exactly.
I'm telling you, we're all living Millennium 7, another Edgar and Cosey White play.
It is. Well, all I can do is thank you so very much. We're going to go into Zoom, everyone. You can see it on God. And we're going to do the after show afterthoughts, so you'll be able to see Dana and I talk for a few minutes if you're interested. So with that, we're going to say good night to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser. Again, remember, you can go to blogtalkradio.com/S, F as in Frank, T as in Tom, H, 2, and see all the back episodes. I'll talk to you soon, Dana. See everyone.
Okay. See you in a minute.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
no, fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you